Hello and welcome everyone. You are listening to the Theology Mill from Whipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I work here at Whipfenstock and I am also the host of this podcast right here, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like what you hear on the podcast, come stop by our website at whipfenstock.com. That's W-I-P-F and stock, S-T-O-C-K.com. In this Luminaries interview, I get to talk with Professor John Swinton, who is a renowned practical theologian and the chair in Divinity and Religious Studies at the University of Aberdeen. On this episode, Dr. Swinton and I discuss his career prior to entering the Theological Academy. We also work through a theology of mental health challenges. We talk about the experience of time for those living with disabilities. And then we also talk about confronting the problems of both radical evil and banal evil, to borrow some terms from Hannah Arendt. Also, you should know that until February 28th of this year, 2023, we will be holding a 40% off coupon code on John Swinton's new book, Deliver Us From Evil. So you can find that coupon code down in the show notes, as well as a direct link to the book. But for your purposes here, the coupon code is DELIVER23, and DELIVER is in all caps. That's DELIVER23. So without further ado, friends, let's head over to the interview. So I am here with Professor John Swinton of the University of Aberdeen, who's a practical theologian and a very prolific one at that. And we are sitting down for a drink. It's past 3 p.m. where he's at and just 7 a.m. where I'm at. So I'm just getting my day started. And I am drinking a black tea blend that also has whole coffee beans, chicory, and carob in it. So it's from this place called the Jasmine Pearl Tea here in Portland. And I think this is maybe my favorite tea that I've ever had, which is saying something because I've had a lot of teas. But that's what I am sipping on. What are you sipping on, John?
Well, nothing so exotic, unfortunately. I have a Coke Zero, which it may mean nothing to you, but it's important to me.
So, hey, that sounds delicious to me.
Well, yes. Well, I did think about good old Scotch whiskey, but it's, even for me, it's a little bit early.
What's the drink that has Coke in it? Is it a Coke and rum? I'm sure there are a few different.
You definitely wouldn't put it in malt whiskey unless you're very wealthy. But yeah, rum and Coke or whatever. Coke goes with most things, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so not all of our listeners will know that you've actually not always been a theologian, that you had a prior career. So could you tell me a bit about what you did before you entered the Theological Academy, and then maybe also how those experiences in your prior career have influenced kind of the way you do theology?
Yeah, of course. Well, before I entered the academy, I was a nurse for 16 years. So I worked alongside people with mental health challenges. So I worked in psychiatry. And then I retrained and I worked for some time in the area of what's now called intellectual disability, which then was called mental deficiency, then mental handicap, then the name constantly changes as culture changes, which tells your story in itself. And so all of my early years were with people who kind of perceived the world differently, who had different experiences, and who raised really important questions about what it means to be human and what it means to live humanly. You know, for example, working with people who live with dementia raises that big question: how do you come to know God when you've forgotten who God is? So big questions that emerge from that kind of way of thinking. And then I worked for a while as a community mental health chaplain, working with people who were coming out of the hospital and moving into society or community, as it was called. And my job was to help them to find a spiritual home. And the first thing I discovered very quickly is that there's no such thing as community in the sense of a place that's open and welcoming to people who are differently. Mm-hmm. Society tends not to welcome strangers. And sadly, I discovered that churches tended not to welcome strangers either. So I learned something important from that. Along the way, I was training to be a minister in the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And I ended up ordained into the Presbyterian Church. But I was ordained into my position at the university. So technically, the university is my parish, but thankfully, practically, it's not, because we've got a very good chaplaincy team that does all that kind of stuff. But it's my place of vocation. And so when I moved into the academy, my task as a theologian was to begin to ask the questions of my own history in that sense, reflect theologically on my experience with people with disabilities, people with mental health challenges, and begin to ask that kind of question, how do I understand all that stuff in the light of what I know about God and mm-hmm. the way I know about human beings? And so although when I look back, it's kind of the path is not obvious to get from being a nurse to a theologian, but actually it makes perfect sense when I look back. Because without that kind of formation, then I would have been a very different theologian, if in fact I'd been a theologian at all.
Sure. Yeah. Have you found ways to kind of stay connected with the sorts of work you did before, like in practical ways?
Yes. I still do a lot of research within the area of nursing and chaplaincy. And all of the kind of field work I do is with people with mental health challenges or people with disabilities. So I'm still, although my position is different and my role is different and my location is different, I still very much engage with people who are working on the ground, if you like.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and I mean, that makes a lot of sense since your work is in practical theology. And for our listeners who aren't maybe familiar with what practical theology is, could you kind of explain what distinguishes that from other subdisciplines in theology? And then also, you know, what does it offer any kind of correctives or contributions in your view to kind of theology more broadly conceived?
Yeah, well, I'd begin by saying that I think all theology is theology. I think it's the academy that splits us up into practical, systematic, or historical, whatever it is. In real life, theology is simply trying to know and understand who God is and who we are before human beings. And we're all pushing in that direction. But having said that, practical theology does have a slightly different way of doing theology. So, if you were studying something like systematic theology, you might sit in your office in a university and reflect on the tradition, reflect on scripture, reflect on the things that people have said, and you come to your own doctrines, your own conclusions about who God is and what it means to be a human being before God. But there's only a limited number of questions that you can ask when you're simply sitting in your office. There's a whole range of questions that you can ask of the tradition that very often don't get asked, but need to be asked. Right? So I'm not in any sense saying there's anything wrong with sitting in your office doing these things. It's important. But the questions that you ask of the tradition is important. So for me, the questions that I brought from my nursing and chaplaincy experience were very different from the questions that my colleagues, for example, would be asking of the tradition. That question, what does it mean to know God when you've forgotten who God is? What does it mean to know God when you haven't got the cognitive capacity to know God? What does it mean to know God when you're going through the depths of depression where God seems to have abandoned you? And all these kind of questions. Mm-hmm. When you ask them of the tradition, you get different angles, answers. It's like looking at a diamond. If you look at a diamond from a different angle, the diamond stays the same, but you just see something you didn't see before. And I think practical theology, at least part of the practical theology task is to do that, to give people different questions, to give an angle so that people can see things they didn't see before. But also, I think for the practical theologian, they always have the need to return to practice. So it's not for a practical theologian, it's very unsatisfactory, if you like, simply to discover that you have knowledge about something. if that knowledge doesn't help you to understand the world more fully and to practice more faithfully. So there is that direct correlation between theory and practice that runs through practical theology and all of its different facets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so moving to kind of your actual work and your book, Finding Jesus in the Storm, which I read in its entirety, and it's a lovely book. But you're addressing the spiritual lives of those who are living with what you term mental health challenges.
Yes.
So I'm curious what your intentions are in using language like mental health challenge rather than something you might hear more commonly like mental illness. Mm-hmm. And then kind of further moving along that route, what role do sort of diagnostic descriptors play in the lives of those who live with mental health challenges?
Well, one of the things that you learn very quickly when you begin to think about issues around disability and issues around mental health is that language really matters. So I mentioned earlier on the idea, you know, that when I trained as a nurse initially, I was a nurse for people who were mentally defective, and then people who were mentally handicapped, then people who were learning disabled. Now, each one of these names or ways of naming reflects something of culture. But to say that somebody is defective is a very powerful statement about what you think they are and what you think perfection is. To say that somebody is handicapped indicates that they're not achieving something that everybody else does. But what that achievement is determined by what everybody else does. So the achievement that individual has by themselves is overlooked. So the language that you use is really important. Now, if you take that into a mental health context, it becomes even sharper. You know, because whilst diagnostic labels are very important for mental health professionals in order to they can carry out their healing tasks, and because it helps you to understand what's going on with that individual in a medical context. The problem is that when the diagnosis leaks out into society, it takes on a life of its own. So, for example, in a clinical context, you have a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and you have a series of treatments that the professionals can give to you to help you to live your life well, hopefully. But of course, as soon as that name, schizophrenia, comes into the public arena, people start talking about schizophrenics. And they think, oh, what on earth is a schizophrenic? Is it like a Spaniard or somebody from New York? Is it like a Londoner? And so suddenly you have this person who becomes a schizophrenic, and nobody knows what that is, and nobody knows what that person is, but they do know that they're different. And as soon as you have that kind of difference and distance, then that's when you have difficulties. And that's why you'll find that whereas the public persona of mental health is very often that people are violent, in reality, it's violence against people who live with mental health challenges that's the big problem there. And it's because of that depersonalization process. Now, the reason why I use mental health challenges is, and I'm not alone in this, but so I haven't invented the term. I just picked it up along the way. So mental illness indicates that there's something wrong with you, that you have an illness. And that the implication for us who live within a very medicalized society is that illness is dealt with by professionals. Nothing wrong with that. But as soon as that happens, two things happen. One, you're always going to be ill, right? So you have to live with being ill for the rest of your life. And two, it means that other caring agencies, such as church communities, can be tempted just to say, well, actually, it's a professional problem. We don't really have, there's nothing really we can do. And so the danger then is that the person finds himself isolated from community and finds themselves in a situation where they're eternally ill. The advantage, I think, of the word term mental health challenges for me is there's a positive dimension. It acknowledges that there's a challenge, and indeed it acknowledges that there's suffering. But the challenges can be faced, challenges can sometimes be overcome, but at least they can be challenged. And there's a positive, forward, hopeful movement for me in the term challenge that I think sometimes can be missing from the term illness. However, people can call their experiences whatever they want. If somebody wants to call their mental health experience illness, I think that's exactly how it should be named. I think the problem would be if you try to force somebody to use the term illness or force somebody to use the term mental health challenge, people can do anything they want. So I'm not trying to be the mental health police in that sense. Mm-hmm. But I do think, particularly for church communities, that that idea of mental health challenge, a minimum ask the question, what can you bring to the table of healing that other agencies can't do? So it opens mm-hmm. up space for us to be there in important ways.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important that people who are living with mental health challenges have a sense of agency as far as how they want to be described or the description they want to like live under. I think that's really important.
Exactly.
Do you feel like the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, I think is what it stands for. I don't know what they use in the UK and Ireland, if they use that or something else, but do you see that as kind of playing a significant role in all of this? And is there any level of like culpability with the DSM and how it's used?
Well, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders is a complicated document. And it's very influential, obviously, in North America. In Europe, it tends to be the World Health Organization, the International Classifications of Disease, which has its own difficulties, of course, but it's slightly different. And what the DSM is intended to do is to give a set of criteria or to lay out a set of experiences that people go through. And if they've had enough of these experiences, then they are given a diagnosis, which is intended then to enable them to get appropriate treatment and also to access insurance and various other things in that sense. So at that level, it's simply a technical document. My problem with the DSM is that it misses out on a lot of things. So it gives us a very bold series of criteria which a psychiatrist then have to make a decision as to whether or not somebody gets this label. But there's two things that I think is tricky, maybe three things. One is the way in which the DSM is put together. So it's put together when psychiatrists, every so often, because it's always changing because people's perspectives are changing. Psychiatrists get together and make certain decisions about what criteria are necessary for a diagnosis. And then that thing, diagnosis, comes into existence. Now, the problem you have, of course, is that it's ever-changing. And so you can have a diagnosis, for example, of Asperger's syndrome at one mm-hmm. point in history, mm-hmm. and then, you know, a few years later, it no longer exists. It's subsumed into a wider category of autism. But the problem is, if you have built your identity around being somebody who has Asperger's, you know, being an Aspie, which is a whole community there, mm-hmm. and then suddenly, officially or formally, you're no longer part of that, that causes problems. So it's a technical move from the perspective of the psychiatrist to help to get a deeper understanding. But the problem is it leaves some people behind with some hidden side effects to that move. Sure. And tied in with that is there was the International Classification of Disease, which is what the European psychiatrists tend to use. They use both of them. It went through another iteration maybe 2 years ago, moving from ICD-10 to ICD-11. And as part of the process for checking it and testing it, a group of people who live with mental health challenges were asked to assess the criterion that were being developed. So it's people who had personality disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, and I think anxiety was the other one. And one of the things that they said once they'd gone through the criteria is, there's nothing positive in there. And so one person who lives with bipolar disorder says, yes, bipolar disorder does have these difficult symptoms and experiences. But what about creativity, he said? What about my ability to write? What about my ability to read? What about the things that I've learned through that? And I thought that was quite interesting that, you know, almost by definition, the DSM or ICD is looking for problems. And that's nothing wrong with that because people, you know, want to have their problems solved. But the danger is that by always looking for problems, you actually overlook some of the things that are positive and constructive in the midst of a person's experience. And that can very easily get silenced or simply been put down as part of the condition. So it's complicated. It's a complicated process. And I would emphasize, I'm not in any sense anti-psychiatry, quite the opposite. I think the key for the church is to be able to work well with psychiatrists. But part of that process is pointing out certain things that are tricky.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think that's great. Like, I think for people who are living with mental health challenges, it's important. I think it can be very much a facet of their experience that their mental health challenge is actually a source of growth, which is where I think the language of challenge is so helpful.
Yeah, I agree.
That it can even be like part of their path to holiness, you know, which is not really in the discussion so much when in terms of like mental illness. So I think that's really helpful.
Yeah.
When it comes to kind of faithfully describing the experience of folks who are living with these challenges, though, I know, in your book, Finding Jesus in the Storm, you kind of turn to like phenomenological approaches to psychiatric care, which is really, really interesting. But do we like what alternatives, if any, do we have to kind of the diagnostic descriptors that we're talking about that tend to sort of pigeonhole people living with these challenges and kind of hem them in along the lines that are drawn for them by kind of the psychotherapeutic establishment?
Yeah. Well, I think the only way that we can begin to break down that kind of difficulty is by listening to people's stories. And so mental health professionals listen to a certain kind of story because they're looking for a way to help an individual with their problem, with the difficulties that they're encountering. And that's a very, very important part of the process. But that's only one part of a person's life. So a person's story is not simply to do with the things that are going wrong, though obviously that's fundamentally important. It's also to do with the things that are going right, the things that people have in terms of the hopes and expectations, the sense of where they can find community, where they can find friendship. And the only way that you can work that out is by listening to people's stories, by sitting down and putting to one side your assumptions about what any particular diagnostic criteria might mean, and listen to the person as the person. Now, I don't mean discarding diagnosis at all. I mean just not allowing your cultural stereotypes and stigma to say, well, this person has schizophrenia, so therefore they're irrational. rather, say, this person has schizophrenia, but let's listen to their story. Let's think about what this feels like. What's it feel like to hear voices? What are you looking for in your life? These kind of things. And that way, we get a balance between the stories that are listened to and held by the professionals and the stories that are listened to and held by an individual and their community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like at the popular level, it seems like in the last, I don't know, maybe 5-10 years, like the public has been like really, like we've been really educated on issues like anxiety and depression, but it seems like with a lot of other diagnoses that are maybe less common, there's still just so much work left to do in terms of people's understanding. Like it seems like we just as a society, whether in the UK or I can only speak to the US, but we just don't have really much of an awareness, certainly not any kind of thick awareness of what these mental health challenges are and what people actually experience. It's just kind of, it seems like it's a lot of caricatures that are based on sort of Hollywood depictions that are not totally false, of course, but I think that are not always faithful and certainly not as textured as they could be.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. So one of the claims you're making in Finding Jesus in the Storm is that in the West specifically, that we as Westerners actually experience more turmoil kind of living under these mental health diagnoses, under these descriptors, and that we experience it more like turmoil more than those in the global South living with the same experiences and the same diagnoses. Mm-hmm. So why do you think that is the case? Like, is there something Is there something particular to Western culture that, and kind of our approach to psychology, that makes us prone to angst over living with these diagnoses?
Well, there is some interesting research done on the differences across culture with certain conditions. So, for example, there's some research that indicates that people will recover from schizophrenia much more effectively if they live in certain parts of Africa than they do if they live in downtown Los Angeles or downtown anywhere. Obviously, it's multifactorial. There's a lot of reasons for it. But one of the reasons that Tanya Lerman has done some really interesting work on hearing voices across cultures, and she points out that the way in which something like psychosis or something like schizophrenia is framed within a Western context is important to understand why it is quite so terrifying. So she talks about the way in which it's completely unnatural for us to hear a voice in a Western context, because the assumption is that your mind is inside your cranium, right? So there's nothing in there apart from your own thoughts. So if you get a thought from outside, then that is terrifying, because that's not the way that your mind works. Because your mind's enclosed, thought from outside is terrifying. That combined with the highly stigmatized approaches that we have to mental health challenges makes it A, really unpleasant, and B, something that you don't want to have, and B, terrifying, because you've got this idea that your mind is of a particular form and shape. But she points out that in the research that she did in India and in Africa, people have very different experiences of voices. And so they'll hear voices that are more friendly. They also sometimes hear really unpleasant voices, but they can also hear voices of the ancestors who will tease them and joke with them. And the idea of hearing voices is not so terrifying for them. The reason for that is that they have a different theory of mind. And so whereas we think that our mind is simply within our cranium, within these cultures, there's a history of your mind being open to the ancestors, open to the community. So you've got the idea that actually your mind is something that's shared within your community, which is something that's very different from the individualistic way in which we think about everything in this context here. Mm-hmm. And so that combined with the fact that they don't really use, or they try to avoid using the term schizophrenia because it's quite stigmatized. People are not necessarily taken out of their home and put into a hospital. They can still very often find a place within community where they can be usefully employed, or where they can feel that they're part of the community. It means that the experience is maybe the same at a technical level, but actually at a sociocultural or psychological level, it's a very different experience between these different cultures.
Yeah, it does seem like the fact that, you know, people living with schizophrenia in the West, that it's like so disruptive to us. I think it almost speaks, I think it speaks a lot, not just to their, you know, the difficulties of what they're living with, but also to our culture it just makes me wonder, like, what is it about us that, which you've explained a bit, but, you know, what is it about our culture that makes it so kind of inhospitable, such that we have to put these people in places where we where the professionals can deal with them, and we don't have to see them and deal with them as such.
Well, I guess part of the problem is that we like minds. You know, we prioritize intellect and reason over community, friendship, relationships. You know, you meet somebody for the first time, and yet the question that most of us ask is, what do you do? And then you place them in a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a brain surgeon, you're fantastic, and so you'll come down from there. And so anything that goes wrong with our minds actually seems to push into our humanness, because we assume that to be rational, to be intellectually capable, that's what good human living looks like. That makes it really difficult for anybody that isn't achieving that. So if you've got an intellectual disability, or if you have dementia, or if you have a mental health challenge that that really pushes against that. Then at the back of people's minds are thinking, not just you've got something wrong with your mind, but actually you've got something wrong with your humanness. So there's a kind of stigmatization, cultural stigmatization built into the way that we look at anything that relates to our minds in that way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So for those who are kind of living with these, with, you know, whatever form of mental health challenges, what's maybe one piece of advice you would give to them, especially for those who are living with them in the West?
Well, I think the one piece of advice that I would give to all of us, well, to somebody living with mental health challenges, don't try and do it on your own. So, I mean, find a safe space. I mean, my thing, if you like, is that the church should be a safe place where people can step aside from these cultural difficulties and these cultural stigmatizations and find a place of safety. Now, I recognize that's not always the case, but it should be the case. Really. So what I'd love to be able to say is, well, if you're going through these difficult experiences, go to a church. They'll help you. They'll understand. However, in reality, very often churches are not like that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, part of my mission in life is to help churches to recognize the significance of this and to become safe places in that. But that, I think for somebody who's going through that cultural stigmatization and living in a difficult place, finding safe spaces is the important thing. But, you know, that's a difficult thing to do. And that's the challenge, is to create places where people really can find an alternative to the way that society is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for those churches that you're kind of trying to train and teach to be more hospitable places, what sort of wisdom or advice do you offer them?
Well, I work with an organization, it's Vancouver based, but they also have a branch in the UK called Sanctuary Mental Health Ministries. They're probably one of the best organizations that I've come across that really provide good, solid teaching materials for religious communities to enable them to A, understand mental health challenges, B, that understand them theologically, and C, be able to create communities where people are welcomed in that sense. So my advice to people would be to have a look at Sanctuary Mental Health Ministries materials, which are absolutely free. So I'm not selling anything. You simply go along to the website and download them. And they're great. And they're a really good way to get into the kind of issues that we're talking about, how we can transform communities into places of belonging.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, so moving from, you know, mental health to kind of just different forms of disability. So in your book, Becoming Friends of Time, which I read parts of, I think I read the introduction and conclusion or something like that. But one of the ideas that really kind of blew my mind was this idea of the temporarily able-bodied. So could you explain kind of what you mean by that term, and then how that idea kind of contributes to theologies of disability?
Yeah, of course. First of all, it's not my term. It's a term that's quite widely used within the area of disability theology. But basically, it's a way of, if there's such a word, of de-othering people with disabilities, because the temptation is always to think, well, I've got a disability, I don't have a disability, you have a disability, so you have a bipolar opposite, disabled, non-disabled. The idea of the temporary able-bodied is that we all are on a journey towards disability. Some of us reach it in different ways, and some of us reach it sooner than others. But as we get old, our bodies break down, and as we get old, we'll inevitably become disabled in one way or another. And so the challenge of recognizing that you're temporarily able-bodied breaks down that dichotomy between able-bodied and disabled-bodied, and helps us to realize we're all on the same journey. We're all moving towards, that sounds a bit negative, but disability is part of all of our life. Disability is part of all of our journey, not just a certain group of people that we may choose to call disabled at any moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I found that really interesting and provocative in a good way. Just because I think it's even if you're working in theology, it's or just in general, honestly, it's so easy to when you think of disability or people living with disabilities to kind of think, like, what does that have to do with my experience if I'm an able-bodied person? But this idea
That's
that
right.
actually I'm just temporarily able-bodied and I will undergo some sort of disability in my life inevitably, I think is really helpful for just having a greater sense of compassion and even just interest in
Yes.
those who are currently living with disabilities.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
In that same book, Becoming Friends of Time, you're also kind of exploring the ways that just social constructions or kind of normative constructions of time affect those people who are living with disabilities. So what sorts of demands do these constructions of time make on people who are living with disabilities? And then what might a conversion to kind of a more gentle timefulness, I think is a term
Yes.
you use. What might that look like for, able-bodied persons in the church who want to kind of include and also empower those who are living with disabilities?
Yeah, well, I think that we need to realize that time doesn't just exist. It always exists in a context. And the way that we experience time in a Western neo-capitalist society is not the same way as you'd experience it necessarily in other parts of the world. Now, think about it this way. The language that we use around time. So we buy time, we use time, we spend time, we take time. Everything that we do with our money, we do with our time. So the language that we use about our time reflects our capitalist economy and what we think is valuable in terms of the usage of our time. So time becomes a commodity within our culture to be bought and sold. I buy your time, you buy my time, and so on and so forth. So it's just like I don't know, it's like a Snickers bar or cornflakes or and you just take it into the marketplace and do your thing. Which is great if you've got if you can keep up. If you're somebody that can move quickly, that can do all the things that time demands of you, that's great. But what about these people that can't? What about people who are slow? What are people those people who think slowly, who take time to be able to process things, who are just by definition slow because of the way that they are? My friend and colleague John Hull, who was a practical theologian in the UK, he went blind in his early 50s, and he talks about the nature of time, and he talks about tying his shoelaces. He says, his friend always commented on how long it took him to tie his shoelaces. And John Hull said to him, "Well, how long should it take?" And he says, "It takes as long as it will take." And I thought that was a really, it takes as long as it will take. So for lots of people, that kind of capitalist time just is just oppressive. Actually, it's oppressive for all of us. Because if you look at the rise of anxiety and depression across Western culture, you can see that the speed that we live on at is just not a healthy speed. And so I think the point I try to make in that book is that for God, time is slow. Look, what was it? Sukakiyama puts it, 40 years in the wilderness is God's basic philosophy. It just takes time. And the theory of evolution says, okay, you'd like to things to go quicker, but it's time. So slow time is important. And the way I frame it in the book, and the kind of illustration I think makes the point is that Kosuke Kiyama, who's a Japanese theologian, he wrote an essay back in the 60s called The 3 Mile an Hour God. And he says, the argument runs like this. The average speed that a human being walks at is 3 miles per hour. Jesus, who is God, walks at 3 miles per hour. Jesus, who is God, who is love, walks at 3 miles per hour. Love has a speed, he says, and it's a slow speed. And I really like that because it means that when you slow down, you notice things. When you slow down, you notice things you wouldn't see at other points of view. Not just with people living with disabilities, intellectual disabilities, I was thinking about in that context, but with all of us. Because if we move too quickly, you miss the specialness of the moment. You miss being with somebody because we're always looking forward to what's still to come. And so much so that we can't notice what's in front of us, not realizing that what's still to come might never come in the first, in the end of things. So I try to make the point in that book that in order to love well and to live well, we need to be slow people. Yes, sometimes we need to rush. Sometimes we need to do quite things quickly. But in our hearts and our souls, we need to be slow people that are centered on what we're doing at this moment in time and centered on what God is doing in and through this moment in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that bit from Kozuke Kayama. I think that's awesome. Yeah. I know. Like I had a buddy who lives with a pretty significant physical disability, and when I first met him, we were both going to seminary, and I was kind of going very part time, and he was going full time. He didn't have a job. I had a full time job, but we would. The way we would hang out is, you know, when we were both at seminary, we would get together for lunch. And I can remember when I first started meeting with him, the sort of pace we would move at to, you know, go to his car, get our chairs, get everything set up on the lawn, start eating, the pace of the conversation. It was actually like quite frustrating to me because I was like, I need to, you know, I have like an hour and I need to get back to work. And what I discovered in time is that it was actually like a real gift to be kind of be forced to slow down to the time he was moving at, and that he actually spending time with him sort of forced me to enter into kind of a more contemplative mode of being that was much more natural to him than it was to me, sort of being rushed and thinking that my work was way more important than it is. So it turned into something that I really appreciated and valued about being with him.
That's great.
Yeah. So you've talked a bit about God's time as being slow, which is awesome. But could you talk a little more to what you mean by God's time? But also like how do we live in his time? Like how do we exist in such a way that's sort of hospitable and receptive to the sort of time that he occupies?
Yeah, I just, when I talk about God's time, I just simply mean recognizing the social construction of time, the way that different contexts, different cultures, different places, we construct time in different ways. And that God is a part of that, but not defined by that. And that God is... not God is within time and at the same time not bound by time in that way. So there's a stillness in time, I think, that is the place where God resides in that way. And I think part of the way in which we become healthy people is to discover that stillness in time and to be with God in the midst of the complexities of the way that we construct time, but recognizing that there's something both within and beyond that we are, that enables us to find a sense of peace and shalom where we are in that way. So I think just noticing God in that way, it's a little bit like the Sabbath. You know, the Sabbath has to do with taking time out and recognizing who God is and then returning to the world again in that way. And most of us can't manage to have a Sabbath in that sense, but we can have Sabbath moments. We can step outside of the things that we're doing at this moment in time, remember who God is, and then step back in again. So that dynamic of Sabbath isn't, I think, necessarily confined to simply one day a week. It can be a way of living and a way of discovering what it means to live in God's time and always to be remembering God in all that we think and say and do.
Yeah, I love that. So One of the things you bring up in Becoming Friends of Time is sort of the significant changes people can undergo when sort of a new disability for them comes or arises, like the onset of some kind of disability. And so it can be easy to sort of think that that person has, you know, is not the same or has sort of irreparably changed. And you know, to kind of wonder, like, what happened to the person you knew, this friend or relative? Even if that person's yourself, that you don't recognize yourself anymore in some way. So are there other ways we might conceive of those kinds of changes, particularly as they sort of relate to the movement or the evolution of a person's vocation as disability starts to become a significant part of their life?
I mean, sitting at the heart of that is the issue of identity, really, or at least part of it is, because one of the things that does happen if we have certain forms of brain damage, whether that's through accident or just by getting old, is that we do change. We do change from being the person that we think we are to being something that is different. I mean, all of us change over time. I mean, I'm not the same person I was when I was 14 in that sense. So we're always on that journey of shifting and changing. But sometimes that can be quite a radical change, so much so that you don't recognize yourself or other people don't recognize you. And that's profoundly, profoundly difficult. It's also profoundly challenging in terms of our faith. Because what does that mean when somebody, for example, has brain damage and is one minute has a deep faith and next minute has no faith at all, or the other way around? Mm-hmm. How are we to make sense of that? But I think as Christians, the issue of identity is important. And the way I would think about it is that none of us find our identity in who we are. Our identity is not discovered purely in our neurological structure. Paul says very clearly that our identity is who we are in Christ. So it's not that who we are as I think I am, how I remember myself to be, or how I was. It's who I am in Christ. And Christ will never abandon us. So we never lose we never lose ourselves in that sense, because Jesus always holds it. And even then, Paul says in Colossians, that our identity is hidden in Christ. So in that sense, none of us really know who we are. We're always dependent on Jesus for our identity. Now, we may not accept that. You know, we may say, well, I know exactly who I am. But there's something very kind of, you'd have to be a bold person to say, I know exactly who I am and I don't need Jesus to tell me who I am. So, you can allude to it in an interesting way. So before I became a Christian, I thought I was a pretty decent guy, living my life and doing all my stuff. Like, then I discovered Jesus, and I discovered I was a fallen person. I discovered I was a sinner. I discovered that a lot of the things that I assumed about myself and the world were just wrong, even though I believed them. And so I moved on. So my self-perception of who I thought I was wrong, even though I was completely convinced it was who it was right. Mm-hmm. But once I discovered Jesus, it shifted. Like, and that our identity this side of glory is a bit like that. We know some things through a glass darkly. We don't know other things. When we have the kind of damage that you're talking about that takes us away from how we perceive ourselves or other people perceive us, then the best that we can do is have faith. You know, because the writer to the Hebrews says, faith is being sure of what you hope for and certain of what you cannot know. And I think that applies to our understanding of God to some extent, and some of the mystery that's in that. But it applies to that situation as well, that we need to hold on to our faith that in Christ, this person is still loved, is still held, is still known, even though these terrible things have happened. And these difficult things have happened. We need to be sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not know. And that's the best that we can do, I think. And off the back of that, we have pastoral strategies that we may want to engage in, to help somebody to deal with the change, to deal with the loss, to deal with the lamentation, to deal with the grief and so on and so forth. But it's that central theological concept that I think that gives us hope in a situation which can very often seem pretty hopeless.
Yeah, I think that's really illuminating too for sort of, like, it just makes me think of like relatives who are either, I mean, maybe not of my own, but just in general, people's relatives, mm-hmm. as they experience them kind of going through old age and, you know, maybe dementia or just physical debilitation and just sort of the ways that, you know, a mind can kind of unravel or a person's, a person's just manner of being can really change. And maybe even that person is not quite as enjoyable to be around as they were before.
Exactly.
And so that can, you know, that can really mess with a person. But I think that idea of like Christ holding us and sort of our identity being hidden in him, you know, in the essence of time. I think that's really illuminating and could be really helpful for people who are trying to make sense of, you know, the experiences that their parents or relatives or just friends are going through as they age. So, okay, let's turn to your newest book with Cascade, which we're really excited about, which is based on your Didsbury lectures. The book's called Deliver Us from Evil. And one of the things you're doing there is you explore evil as it's treated by two different thinkers, one the New Testament scholar Susan Eastman, and then the other the Jewish philosopher Hannah Arendt. I'm probably butchering her last name, but what do those two have to say about evil, and how do their ideas kind of contribute to your argument?
Yeah, well, they're both really interesting thinkers in different ways. Susan Eastman's she points out that in Romans, the first seven chapters in Romans, Paul lays out the nature of evil and the nature of sin. And the way that he describes evil is that effectively he says evil occurs when you put your thoughts and your words and yourself in the place where God should be and assume that that's what God is saying. And the reason that that's so dangerous, apart from the obvious, is that you can no longer work out what the truth is, because you think that that what you're saying is true, what you're saying is godly. So therefore, you lose sight of what God is really saying in that way. And it just struck me when I read her exposition of that, is that there's something profound about that in relation to a cultural context where we have fake news seems to be the thing, where it's very difficult to work out what truth is, and where everybody thinks their truth is truth, but in fact none of it seems to be truth. So we get dislocated in that sense, and it's that sense of dislocation from the truth and in the inability to do what is right that Paul describes it as the essence of evil. Sin, he says, as we move on to into chapter 7, he says it's a power that pushes down on us, that we have to be aware of if we're to resist. Ultimately, you can't resist it. Ultimately, I think it's the Holy Spirit. It's only through the Holy Spirit that you can begin to resist it. But that idea that there are powers and principalities is really, really important, pushing down. So these two ideas are important. Because importantly, Paul says, you can be deeply implicated in evil and not even know it. But he also says, you're still responsible, which is deeply troublesome. And Hannah Arendt, she says something similar. So in her earlier work on totalitarianism, she talks about the idea of radical evil. And so for her, radical evil is something like the Holocaust, something like the concentration camps. And there is an attempt not just to dehumanize people, but to take away the very concept of humanity. So take away the idea of spontaneity, take away the idea of identity, take away the idea of hope. Everything is completely destroyed in a frenzy of destruction and terror, but for no real reason, because it didn't have to happen. In fact, something like the concentration camps and the things that went on there, actually in the end were detrimental to the Nazi regime. So why would you do it? So she says it's just, the whole thing is just meaningless. And so her radical evil is just meaningless. However, when she was sent to report on the trial of Rudolf Eichmann, who was an administrator who was responsible for the transportation of Jewish people to the concentration camps and to their ultimate destruction, she changed her mind. Because as she watched Eichmann day after day in the trial, she realized that this guy was, as she put it, a clown. It's somebody who simply came out with repetitive statements, with stereotypes. Guy who just did his duty and without thinking about it. Hmm. He just, you know, as long as the trains were running, that was all he seemed to matter to be interested in. And she talks about, she develops the idea of the banality of evil. So previously she thought that evil didn't have was mysterious, didn't have a reason, didn't have an explanation. And suddenly she realized that the explanation was thoughtlessness, that this guy just wasn't thinking. Now, she got a lot of criticism for that because obviously that seems to minimize the tremendous evil. But her point is really important, because if you don't think about things, you get sucked into all sorts of evil. Yeah. If you don't think about things, just like Paul says, you find yourself, you're no longer able to discern good from evil. And so a simple example would be, ask the question, what circumstances was your iPhone or your telephone made in? What kind of labor went into that? Next time you flash your credit card to get that cheap shirt or that cheap pair of shoes, what are you supporting with your money there? What kind of conditions is it people that are living in that do it give you your cheap shoes and so on? So you get sucked into it because you don't think about it. And it struck me that these two, a philosopher and a theologian, these two people, actually were saying something really important about the contemporary world, that all of us seem to be implicated in evil, but none of us think that we are. And we need to have our consciousness raised so that we can at least have some degree of discernment in the way that we live our lives. And that we don't do exactly what Paul says, which is to be implicated in evil, be responsible for evil, and just not to know about it.
Yeah, I think her idea of banal evil or the banality of evil, I like that helps a lot, I think, in kind of making sense of some of the situation, at least in America, of like, I know I and a lot of others have been really dumbfounded when we have people in our lives who seem like really solid Christians who, you know, who we really enjoy and even admire, who seem to be really holy people, and then they sort of fall under, you know, the prey of, you know, whatever it is, Christian nationalism or racism or xenophobia or whatever, and you hear them say certain things and it's like, what just came out of your mouth? And it's sort of shocking because it feels like it's in such discord to the rest of their life. Like it feels like, how could you not see the disparity or the discrepancy? But I think that this idea of the banality of evil, of like, they just haven't thought through the implications, or they're not in a social situation. They're not in a sort of a social context that would encourage thoughtfulness about those things, or about those people. I think that's helpful to kind of understand why people are sort of drawn into the things they are that you wouldn't expect them to be. What can the church do, and individual Christians as well? What can we do to sort of resist evil in the world? It's a big question, I know.
Well, I mean, be thoughtful. Teach your children the art of critical thinking. Help them to think for themselves, and think for yourself, and be aware that there are powers and principalities, as Paul says, that are pushing down on us and trying to get us to live in ways and to see the world in ways that are profoundly destructive. when you begin to step back a little bit and think about our economic system and think about the way in which our politics has beginning to run, the way in which there's kind of corruption built into certain powerful systems, when you begin to notice that, you begin to see that actually what Paul says about powers and principalities, it isn't mystical, it's actually very important. So critical thinking, becoming aware of the powers and principalities and all the different forms, and beginning to live into truth. So it seems to me that one of the things that the gospel is intended to do is to enable us to see the world clearly. And when we read the stories of Jesus and the stories of Paul, they're trying to get us to look out in the world and see things clearly, see things differently, see to reframe the way that the world is in the light of what the life of Jesus tells us. So when you find groups of people who claim to be religious, for example, but have no interest in the poor and no interest in justice, you have to ask yourself, which part of Jesus' life are they modeling in that sense? When you see political powers that are clearly xenophobic and clearly pushing people to be against their neighbour, to rather than to accept the stranger and welcome them as if they were angels, to reject the stranger, then you know there's something wrong. But the problem is, when you're in the midst of it, all that can seem absolutely normal. Well, all mm-hmm. these things can be seen just like, well, that's fine. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. Of course we can't take any more people into our country, or of course we can't give away our own money to the poor, or whatever it is. Like, mm-hmm. And then you say, of course you're right, and you find yourself with a kind of cultural blindness. So just step back and have a look at what's going on, and think, to be simplistic, what would Jesus do? And when I say simplistic, I don't mean simplistic stupid, but I simply mean it's a simple test. What mm-hmm. would Jesus do?
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, that's great. Okay, well, I think this is a great place to wrap up. It's been a joy to spend some time with you. So thank you for taking the time. It's been a real treat. I appreciate it.
Yeah, nice to meet you, Zach.
You as well.